Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman of Vocalo.org, 89.5 FM.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
Our topic today is high-speed rail and its future in the U.S.
High-speed rail refers to passenger train service operating at an average speed of 124 miles an hour or greater. Most European countries have extensive high-speed rail networks, as do Japan and China. The United States currently has no high-speed rail service.
Hold on, Professor. What about the Acela Express that operates in the Northeast?
Well, technically, the Acela Express is a high-speed train, which does in fact briefly reach 150 miles per hour on some routes, but its average speed is significantly less, for example, 80 miles per hour between New York City and Washington, D.C. High-speed trains have had real success abroad, but are market conditions in the U.S. suitable for this technology? We have with us today Rick Harnish, who's executive director of the Midwest High-Speed Rail Association, to discuss this topic, mainly focusing on the Midwest states. Mr. Harnish, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Midwest High-Speed Rail Initiative? What's the motivation, and give us a sense of your plan?
The Midwest High-Speed Rail Association is a member-supported nonprofit advocating for fast, frequent, and dependable trains linking the entire Midwest. And we've recently been promoting a 220-mile-an-hour line as a kind of test case or the first step towards looking at what 220 miles an hour would look like in the Midwest.
Now, 220, you're saying that's a top speed, right?
Correct.
In our little introductory notes, we mentioned 124 mile an hour average speed as sort of a base to define a high-speed rail system. Is that 124 mile an hour average in line with what you guys are proposing?
Well, a group of large employers in St. Louis have started looking at what they do to change their economy so that they fit more into the global marketplace. And one of their requirements is to become 2 hours away from Chicago. And in order to get 2 hours away from Chicago, you need to average 150 miles an hour.
So is your organization supporting that kind of speed or a faster high-speed train?
We need to set a goal of having our major economic centers within 2 hours of each other. And so that's, in most cases, that's averaging about 150.
When you say our major centers, dealing with the Midwest, what cities now are we talking about bringing to within 2 hours of Chicago?
With, off-the-shelf technology, you could have Chicago-Indianapolis in an hour and 15 minutes or so, Chicago to Cleveland probably in just over two, certainly Detroit within two, Cincinnati within two, and Minneapolis-St. Paul in the 2.5 hour range.
So what's the technology you're talking about?
The passenger trains. So the Siemens Valero E is good for those speeds, the TGV. Certainly a couple of different versions of the Shinkansen. It's all off-the-shelf stuff.
Do you have a sense what a ticket might cost to go to Minneapolis in 2.5 hours?
Certainly less than Southwest would charge. So on the Chicago to St. Louis study that we're doing, we're assuming a low fare of $45 Chicago to St. Louis and a high fare of 150.
So could you tell us a little bit about that study? I mean, for example, you say you're assuming those fares. Is there a basis for that assumption?
We looked at what, the current market costs were with Southwest Airlines and other airlines, and we looked at successful systems around the world. And the French have the most successful high-speed rail system in the world. And one of the things they do is they keep their fares very low, and that allows them to carry a very high volume.
So how are they able to keep the fares low? Is it publicly subsidized?
The operation of the TGV is not publicly subsidized.
So then I don't understand the logic. How can you set the fares low? Either the costs are low or doesn't it need to be subsidized?
So the costs are low, yeah. So you have trains that carry 1,100 people.
So they're making it on volume.
So it's all in the volume.
Do you have a sense from your studies what the cost would be to build this kind of network in the Midwest that, that your organization would like to see?
Our base case is O'Hare to Union Station or the West Loop Transportation Center, McCormick Place, perhaps a park and ride on the south side, Kankakee, Champaign, Decatur, Springfield, Edwardsville, which would be a park and ride for St. Louis, and downtown St. Louis. And it looks like it's about $13
billion. $13 billion just for the St. Louis run?
That compares with, you know, the $2 billion project to rebuild 40 miles of expressway in Wisconsin, you know, $1 billion to build a new expressway between Freeport and Galena in northwestern Illinois.
So the cost that you're talking about, does that include the cost? That's new right-of-way and guideway from end to end?
We actually, in our case, are assuming a more expensive choice. So rather than going cross-country, which would be significantly less expensive, one of our core beliefs is that you should reuse existing assets as much as you can. So we're talking specifically on the Chicago to Champaign portion that the state would buy half of the right-of-way, build a new line for the CN on the remaining half, build the new high-speed line alongside of it, and then grade separate the entire thing between Chicago and Champaign.
So, and that's included in the $13 billion cost estimate?
Correct.
Is the West Loop terminal included as well?
Not at this point.
Now, have you done any figures on the whole system? Because you had mentioned Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Detroit, this sort of spider web with Chicago in the center. Any figure on what the entire shebang would be?
No, but, you know, some of the most expensive stuff is within Chicago. So you build that, and you serve any place south and east of Chicago.
And who pays for it?
A variety of sources, the same kind of sources that pay for highways or airports or whatever.
Well, the highways are paid for substantially by motor fuel taxes. So is there
in the 60 to 70% range in capital costs, right. But the challenge is that, and you know this very well, our current system of paying for the highways is not working anymore.
No, it isn't working, but I'm just trying to figure out how you transfer that kind of a resource to high-speed rail.
That's a decision that we have to make as a public. We have to say that this is something that we want, something that's critical to our future, which it is, and then we figure out how to pay for it.
Have you pursued, where do things stand in terms of pursuing funding from government sources?
The state, as part of its overall application, submitted a request for $5 million as part of a $10 million project to begin the engineering and environmental work on a Chicago to St. Louis line on an undetermined route. You know, we've suggested a route, but it's up to the state to go through the formal process to pick a formal route.
Now, 5 to 10 million in a project that's $13 billion. Where is this money part of the stimulus package? Where are you looking to get the billions?
Through a federal appropriation.
Which would be a part of the stimulus bill, is that correct?
No, the stimulus is done. So that's $8 billion. You know, there's some number of projects that are going to come out of that. One of them will be upgrading the Chicago to St. Louis main line to 110 miles an hour, which provides what I would call super commuter rail for all of the communities on the line. This is a decision we have to make. Do we want to remain players in the global marketplace as a Midwest region, or do we want to lose our competitiveness as we go forward and, you know, continue to have increasing costs for auto travel and continued reductions in air travel?
And why, in the opinion of your association, is it necessary to make this investment in order to remain players? And why is that so?
Because, you know, if you can choose to be anywhere in the world, typically you would choose to be in a place that is, one, an attractive place to live and do business, one that has low costs of doing business, and one that you can move around in fairly easily. And as we go forward, driving is getting to be much more expensive and will continue to get worse. Our airline service is declining, whereas our competitors are actually making their cities closer together, making their cities much more attractive with huge investments in public transit and biking. and we're letting our systems deteriorate.
Now, I imagine all throughout the United States, there are regions that see the same benefits that you see and will be vying for monies as well. How do you make the particular case for the Midwest?
We've got about a third of the population of the country within a 500-mile circle of Chicago. O'Hare is a key link to the entire globe through its international flights. And we're still, you know, the major agricultural and industrial center of the country. And it's critical that those resources be connected to the rest of the economy. And the way to do that is with high-speed rail.
So when you talked about your estimates or your assumptions about pricing, and when you combine that with what you expect the demand will be, do you think that will cover the operating costs, the operating and maintenance costs for high-speed rail?
Absolutely.
Do you believe, could you make a case that the capital cost of installing it would be recovered?
No, we can't at this point. But, you know, we're not really sure how we're going to finance O'Hare at this point. So it's...
Right. And when you go to make this sale, to make this pitch, who is the recipient? Who are you pitching this to?
The business leaders of the cities that are already noticing the pain. So the St. Louis, the Decatur, the Springfield, the Champaign.
The pain being the economic difficulties that this would address?
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you envision that we're going to see a national network of high-speed rail at some time in the future?
Well, I would hope that we would have some key trunks of 220-mile-an-hour high-speed line.
Now, you had mentioned St. Louis. Are you further developed in plans for St. Louis? Is the first push for St. Louis with Minneapolis, Cleveland, Detroit, et cetera, to follow, or are you pursuing all of these cities at the same time?
Well, what needs to happen is, as we move forward with some the major decisions that we're facing on transportation finance, on climate change issues, on all of those things, we need to talk about the vision and begin implementing the vision of having the entire country connected with highly competitive passenger trains. And so the stage of the game we're at now, I hope it doesn't take as long as it did to fight through the interstate highway system. But, you know, when they drew the first interstate highway system map in 1937 and said, we're going to connect the entire country with all-weather, safe, high-volume highways, they made that decision in 1937. And that's what the process we're at right now is we need to decide as a country to do that.
So who are your members? Are they businesses or individuals or both?
For the most part, individuals. Some of them putting in, you know, $15 or $20, and some of them putting in tens of thousands of dollars. You know, a few corporations here and there, and a lot of cities throughout the Midwest of the Winona size cities that are already feeling a lot of pain, especially as they have, you know, seen a severe cutback in air service.
But one of the concerns I would have is when you mentioned the smaller cities like Winona and perhaps Kankakee, as you design a service that stops in those places, doesn't that take away from the high-speed nature of the service? That is, doesn't it cut your average speed between the major departure points?
Well, that's why you've got the high-speed trunks, and you've got the 90 to 110-mile-an-hour trains operating on the heavy haul network.
I see.
And one thing I would do very quickly is change the regulation that says you can't run high-speed trains on the heavy haul network. Because, you know, if you could build segments of this the way we build segments of the interstate, for example, you know, Chicago to Minneapolis, if you could upgrade Chicago to Milwaukee, Chicago to Madison, or actually put in 220-mile-an-hour track, and then maybe extend it to Portage, and then upgrade the other three routes, you could have incredibly frequent service to Madison, which is needed, hourly service, and then split it three ways, and still have something much better than what we've got today to Minneapolis as a step in the right direction.
So when you're saying, you refer to the regulations, you're talking about Federal Railroad Administration regulations about mixing light-duty passenger cars and freight?
Correct.
Is it necessary, if a train's going to go 220 miles an hour, to build special tracks for it, or can a train run that fast, a specially built train, run that fast on tracks that exist right now?
You would need to build completely new tracks.
So they need its own tracks. And I'm assuming a two-hour run from St. Louis to Chicago is an express that's not stopping anywhere in between?
No, we assume stops in Champaign and Springfield.
Okay, so but the project then would be to build a whole set of tracks running between here and there.
Absolutely.
And at $13 billion, is the expense mostly in that, laying of those tracks?
Now, if you're a highway builder, you love this project, because every time the highway went over the tracks, we counted that as a highway project. We didn't count, even though it's the same kind of labor, when we lifted the tracks up over the road. But there's about $5 billion in pure highway work in this. So if you're a highway builder, this is an excellent project, and you should be behind it.
So those are people you're calling on the phone to saying, would you like to join our group?
Yes.
So give us a guess. How long are we going to have to wait for this service?
It depends. If we want to go through the normal process, if we want to go through the FTA process, which is designed to slow everything down in order to make it appear that there's less demand for rail transport than there is, if we want to use the current FTA process, we'll never have it. If we want to say that this is critical to the future of the economy and we're going to make it happen, you know, we could start seeing real segments of this within a decade. And we would like the president and our governor to say that we're going to have this first high-speed line up and running for the 2016 Olympics.
One very, very quick thing. We're going to find out in about a month if these Olympics are coming to the region. How do you handicap it? Is that a big win for you guys if the Olympics are coming here?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, you've given us some really useful insights into this exciting idea. We'll hold our breaths and wait and hope we don't have to wait too long.
Hold your breath. Call your senator and say you want $4 billion for high-speed rail in the 2010 appropriation.
We're on it. Thank you very much, okay. Mr. Harnish. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Now, of course, by the time this airs, Professor will know about the Olympic question. So this interview is taking place about a month before then, but people will be hearing it. By the time people hear it, that'll be known.
We'll know it, yes.
Would you get on a train like that? Would you feel safe going along 220 miles an hour on a train?
One of the issues about FRA compliance that's really important is what that really says is that you can't run a light-duty rail car, particularly a passenger car, on a line where there's a possibility, under the worst of circumstances, that it might encounter a 300,000-pound or heavier freight car, such that a head-on collision would result in telescoping of the car. So the FRA says you can't mix that kind of traffic. So if you look at, for example, the recent rail transit crashes in Washington, where they had head-on collisions with the same kind of vehicle, they had telescoping collapse of the cars and approximately, I think, 9 fatalities. So if you mix with heavy freight traffic, the risk is much higher. It doesn't mean you can't guard against it, but that's what FRA compliance means.
Well, now, he was saying, if I understood him correctly, that this 220-mile-an-hour thing would be on its own set of track.
Well, but his idea, which I think is a really interesting idea, is to articulate the implementation so you could do it segment by segment. And so you run this equipment, what they call in the rail industry a consist, or a set of cars, on the high-speed route, and then run it through to the next city on a lower-speed route in mixed configuration, where it would be on a track where it's possible it could encounter a freight train, and that's where the risk comes. What you need to guard against it is you have a control system that says it can never happen.
You do that so that it's partially built, so you don't build, yeah. You have to build the whole stretch in one.
So one of the interesting ways of looking at a high-speed rail investment, let's just talk about Chicago to Minneapolis, you're going to put a lot of money into that before you get any benefit at all, because it's got to start in Chicago and go to Minneapolis. Well, if you can articulate it, you can break it into chunks and say, well, we're going to do Chicago to Milwaukee and then Chicago to Madison. So you invest money and you get a return because you can carry people on those shorter distances before you get the whole system done.
Improve the value of it along the way to get investors.
Yeah, well, that, which is a really good marketing strategy.
Are you going to be in line for a ticket?
I'm already in line. Yes.
Thanks a lot, Professor.
All right. Thank you.